This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Today's sponsor is BetterHelp Online Therapy. More about them in a bit. So back in 1859, in his famous essay on liberty, John Stuart Mill wrote that he who knows only his own side of the case knows little of that. What he meant was that if you don't test your beliefs by engaging with people who disagree with you, you're more likely to make weak, incomplete, self-serving, or just irrelevant arguments. And that can lead to really bad outcomes in policy matters, or it can just lead to really bad misunderstandings in social life. You know, if we want an open society, we need robust, systematic, good faith debate. And that's where the group Open to Debate comes in. It was founded in 2006 as Intelligence Squared US. And since then, it's hosted hundreds of debates with the goal of restoring critical thinking, facts, reason, and civility to American public discourse. Yeah, it's got its work cut out for it. Through a mix of online and in-person events, Open to Debate brings together artists, officials, public intellectuals, scientists, entrepreneurs from all across the political spectrum and ideological spectrum to work through contentious, heated, and seemingly irresolvable issues of the day. Reason people have participated in these things. Catherine Mangu Ward, our editor-in-chief of All Things Journalism, was part of a great debate that asked, is capitalism a blessing? She was joined on that one by John Mackey, the former CEO of Whole Foods. I've participated in a bunch of Open to Debate events, too, including one where I argued for legalizing all drugs, and then I've argued against Medicare for All, net neutrality, and forgiving student loan debt. Gives you an idea of the range of topics that they cover. I'm also moderating debates for them, too, in New York City. Open to Debate invites audience participation, and it airs all of its programming on NPR, YouTube, and the group's own website, where it provides massive notes and materials that are all designed to help audience members reach an independent and informed conclusion. This stuff goes out to a big audience, and it really has an impact on not just what we think, but how we think. My guest today is Open to Debate CEO, Clea Connor, who tells me about her group's mission, why it changed its name a couple months ago, and its push, and this is pretty exciting, to host actual presidential debates that would force the candidates to engage one another and to get past the BS. So instead of watching joint press conferences with rehearsed talking points, we might actually get some information about how the men and women who are running for president would actually behave in office. This is an interesting, slightly offbeat episode. I think you're going to like it. Here is the Reason interview with Clea Connor. Clea Connor, CEO of Open to Debate. Thanks for talking to Reason.
Hi, Nick. Thanks so much for having me.
So start off, what is Open to Debate and what do you do and what are the goals of the organization?
Open to Debate is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. We consider ourselves a debate-driven media company. So we are curating conversations and experiences where people can engage with opposing views on complex issues in a respectful and thought-provoking way. We're also trying to create a contempt-free zone where you can have an open mind, where you can question your own values, your beliefs, your biases, and learn something in the process. Because debate encourages us to actually have to listen to somebody we may disagree with or a point of view that we find no merit in and understand where they're coming from and perhaps shift our thinking or reinforce our own beliefs. So it's a process. It's a way of learning. It's a way of solving problems. It's a way of making better decisions.
It seems hopelessly old-fashioned, right? I mean, the idea that you would, you know, I'm joking, and I know the organization. I participated in some of your past debates and whatnot. But you know, the idea that you would, that you would engage civilly with somebody you know is wrong. That seems kind of old-fashioned.
Well, I think even what you just said, you know, is wrong, is kind of part of the problem. How do you know they're wrong?
Yeah. I mean, well, you know it in your bones, right? Or say, I mean, that's certainly the way we talk about, I guess.
I think that conviction we have in society now, that's what's creating the extreme polarization and just the gravitation toward extremes. Mm-hmm. And so if you come into a scenario, and you could extrapolate this to almost anything in your life, knowing you're right, you're not going to be able to question where you got that conviction and how to maybe expand it or how to actually solve the problem that is surrounding that belief.
What are Open to Debate started life as Intelligence Squared US. Talk a little bit about the difference. You know, what's encoded in the shift from Intelligence Squared as a name for mm-hmm. the organization and the platform to Open to Debate?
Yeah, Intelligence Squared was founded in the UK in the early 2000s. And it was, I like to say we're a British import, or we used to be a British import. And we came to the US in 2006. Our chairman of our board, Robert Rosenkrantz, who's a philanthropist and financier, saw at this dawn of cable news in like the early 2000s there, a real problem emerging for American culture and society. And that is these incredibly biased media networks that were just reinforcing one point of view. And he thought this is not going to have a positive net effect on democracy, policymaking, you know, American life in general.
And it's kind of bizarre, right, that at the moment when we had more space and time on cable and on the internet where you could really air longer versions of arguments, you could bring in more points of view, you know, that isn't what happened. You know,
no.
People seem to gravitate towards shorter, punchier, you know, kind of pre-scripted Punch and Judy shows,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you could even, and maybe we'll talk about this later, reference the first televised debate in American history, which was the 1960 debate with Kennedy mm-hmm. and Nixon, and how that was so completely different than what people would call a real debate or any academic debate,
what
or
do you
even
mean?
A debate format.
Yeah. What do you mean by that?
It had it's questioning, you know, it's asking a lot of questions and getting answers back and not necessarily going through a point counterpoint sort of process, which is sort of inherent to debate. But that's what people... that was their first exposure to a televised debate in American history. And what you could definitely argue, that's not a real debate. I mean, even the organizers of that debate would say that. Let me say that again. Even the organizers of that debate would agree.
So you go from Intelligence Squared, which is, you know, kind of like, okay, this is a bunch of bright people talking to, you know, the only people who would appreciate this are also smart. It's not just intelligence. It's like, you know, Intelligence Squared, right? Or cubed or whatever. So Open to Debate. What's encoded in that?
Encoded in that is, I think, the shift that we're making from being Intelligence Squared US, having an affiliate with our British counterparts who are still producing a lot of content, and recognizing America's reached an inflection point. Things are different now. Discourse is different now. The impact of technology, of media, of misinformation, of the fragmentation of our access to information. We wanted to, after coming out of the pandemic, which, by the way, we kind of reinvented our business. We went from being a live events organization, which we shared with our, you know, Intelligence Squared DNA across the pond, to now being more of a digital first, you know, company. So podcasts, radio program, a lot of digital video, newsletters. We democratized our content. We want to reach as many people as possible. But as a nonprofit organization, we're also here to address a problem and a need. And we wanted to address this moment in time in this country and going forward when you have cancel culture, you have the academy up in arms about intellectual diversity, you have huge shifts and changes in trust in our institutions broadly, to come up with a name that reflects the work we do, that's accessible, that's also a call to action. And Open to Debate is a reminder of what we need to be in society. It's also what we actually do. Intelligence Squared wasn't very clear. I mean, you could think we're in counterintelligence, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
So Open to Debate is really all about starting a new posture to grow into being like the debate-driven media organization for the U.S.
Who is who's your audience?
Our audience is an intellectually curious, you know, open-minded individual, primarily self-selected, but we distribute our debates pretty broadly. So the audience is NPR listeners. We have a broad podcast subscriber. We have a lot of people on our newsletter list. And these are all people that have come to us by way of individual debates we've produced over time. Maybe they're issue-oriented listeners trying to understand, you know, two sides of a complex thing that's really important to them. They're, you know, intellectually curious about debate generally. A lot of students as well. During the pandemic, we saw our demographics shift significantly online. So it's now 24 to 34.
I was going to say a bad joke. You lost a lot of your older listeners during the pandemic, right? As did everyone. Talk a bit about the structure of debate, because you know that is. I want to get to some of the topics you know that have been particularly successful or interesting. But you know, what's the structure of debate, and how is that different than you were saying about the 1960 presidential, debate? It was really kind of like, what do you think about this? Hey, what do you think about this? And it, right. How is debate distinct from just kind of giving people a platform to make their pitch?
Debate's distinct because it should be structured. The presidential debates, for instance, that we see, they're not structured as an actual debate. So the inherent, structure of debate brings two sides together. You have opening remarks that are uninterrupted. So you are sitting and listening to your, say, if you want to call it your opponent, but let's just say the other side. You're sitting and listening to someone else and actively listening to their arguments because you're going to address them later. And if you're not listening, you can't do that. So each side is given uninterrupted time to present, make their case, present their opening arguments. Then you have a moderator come in, which is very different than the kind of moderators we see in the American political debates, as it pertains to an Oxford-style format or a parliamentary-style format. The moderator is really honing in on an argument on one side, bringing it to the other side, in what you'd call a point-counterpoint, and actually trying to understand where, you might be able to agree or why you disagree and find some resolution on each one of those point-counterpoint. Right.
And I mean, in the best of your debates that I both have participated in, but, watched a lot of them, it's really, the term that gets used a lot now is steel-manning the other side's argument. The moderator really goes in and says, I don't understand what you're saying here, or you haven't addressed this bit of data or this analysis, so do that. That seems to be what is genuinely missing, in a lot of contemporary, we have a lot of conversation, but we don't have that much debate.
Right. I mean, the difference is that you hold the other side accountable for what they say in a debate. In a conversation or a media appearance or a podcast or something, your arguments are going unchallenged. But when you have somebody who's a worthy opponent, right, engaging in your ideas, challenging your ideas, that's where you learn. So that's what we don't actually see often.
And part of these are Oxford-style debates, meaning that the audience votes beforehand and afterhand. Is that important, or what is the function of that in the debates that you guys put on?
The function of that, so that is an Oxford style debate. So that's one of the formats that we produce at Open to Debate. And that really we started out with as Intelligence Squared. Mm-hmm. So Oxford style debate, by either it could be as rudimentary as a round of applause or a show of hands, or the way we do it with mobile voting to track a two-time voter. But yeah, you cast a vote before you've heard anything. You listen to the debate. Then you cast a second vote. And what we like to see is where the opinions shifted. And we used to declare a winner, that the side that changes the most minds is the winner of the debate. But we know that that's a flawed system. We know that any sort of voting system where you're polling 400 people, say, in New York City, doesn't necessarily represent how 400 people would vote in California, Texas, or Wyoming, for instance. So,
but it does give the debaters kind of something to shoot for, right?
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. 100%. Because you also want to know how your arguments resonated with that audience. Mm-hmm. And so getting feedback in real time is important to people who take to a debate stage. Because you are also, as a debater, you're crafting your arguments, you're building ideas around how people react to you and how your audience
Which
engages.
Is also, I mean, just fascinating because it's like, you know, partly you want to be analytical and you want to hit them in the brain, but you also want to hit them in the stomach or the heart, right?
Completely.
So it's like, I mean, this is, you know, I mean, it's a good question about debate. And when you think about political debate, how much of it is people using facts, however defined, to convince people and how much is appeals to emotion?
I don't know what that word means anymore, facts. Do
yeah.
you?
No,
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I have some.
No,
yeah.
I mean, that's what debate is. Debate is all about the fact that there are facts.
Right.
Both sides come to the table with data, you know, with reasoned analysis around those data points and with facts. But debate creates the opportunity to scrutinize those facts. And so what we've seen happen today is you can have something that's really actually not a fact or not qualified. That's what we're calling broadly misinformation spread through the internet and become a serious problem because people are believing something that could be really harmful to them or to their environment or even their families and so forth, certainly the country. So debate is almost a preventative measure to that kind of wildfire spread of misinformation.
How, I mean, not to get too dragged off topic, but how much of misinformation, it's really, there's information and some of it's good, some of it's bad, or you might have certain facts or certain beliefs that you absolutely take to be true that other people disagree with. And, you know, you do want to adjudicate that but by the same token, there are certain issues in which you're never going to come to that kind of resolution. And is that really what's going on? It's just that, you know, the world of information has been so democratized that nobody has to listen to you anymore. And might that be a good thing on some level?
Well, that's a lot to unpack.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I might start by saying, is it a good thing not to have to listen to people who are unqualified to make sort of recommendations or let me think about that. So what's your question? Is it a good thing that we have so much information that you don't have to listen to people? You can curate a feed that reflects the things you care about. You can curate your online experience, your inbox, your Twitter feed, your Facebook feed, all of those places to, you know, kind of eliminate the crazy, let's say, or points
or
of view
you
that
can, what I consider
what you
crazy.
Think is crazy.
Yeah.
Right. Eliminate points of view you don't want to hear.
Yeah.
You know, say it's bigotry or say it's just stupidity
right.
or say it's, you know, the or same photo of
I
mean, the pasta
yeah,
that
like
you've seen 18 times.
You know, it's like I want to get rid of all the white supremacy in my feed or I want to get rid of all of the, you know, Black Lives Matter stuff in my feed, right?
Right.
Is that a good thing that we are probably more in control of our feeds than we used to be?
I would argue no, because what that leads to is extremism on both sides. Mm-hmm. If you can't check things in real time, and if you can't actually challenge or engage in the free expression of ideas in real time, you end up with extremism that just sort of consolidates and explodes. And I think we've seen that happen. You've not only seen that happen in the United States, you're seeing it globally, because that's the impact of technology everywhere.
So is part of the function of what you guys are doing or debate in a free society is kind of forcing people to say, look, here are some facts that we agree on or that we should agree on. Like this stuff really happened. And by focusing on that, we can then start to have better conversations. So, you know, George Floyd was killed by the Minneapolis police.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, after that, things might get blurry depending on your point of view or your, you know, ideological priors, but like forcing people to, you know, focus on that and then move out, that's kind of what you're doing. You're tethering this free-for-all of information to specific data or facts that, okay, let's focus on this and see what happens.
I mean, a debate begins with a sharply framed resolution or a question mm-hmm. that presupposes that we're agreeing on a certain data pool and a mm-hmm. certain set of facts. Yeah. And that's what makes it so distinct from, say, just a public opinion show or a talk
right.
show,
yeah.
you know, or a partisan media, mm-hmm. you know, company. Yeah. So you're coming to the table with two sides or multiple perspectives
right.
oftentimes.
Right.
But you are debating to agree on a baseline of information.
Right.
So okay. that's inherent to debate.
Yeah,
otherwise, you're talking past each other.
What are some of the most successful debates that you've had? And how do you define a successful debate? I assume part of it is like, well, you know, this one got like a bazillion people to watch, or this one caused a riot or something, you know,
yeah.
or but, you know, what are some of the most successful debates that you've hosted? And why did they work so well?
Well, first, we call every one of these debates that we produce a miracle.
Yeah.
Because it's a five-way negotiation, really, with building a team. In an Oxford-style debate, it's two teams of
right.
two with a moderator. But even if you're curating a conversation that's one-on-one, there is still so much that goes into your decision, for instance, Nick, to debate. Just the wording of the question, because a few different words gives you an advantage or gives your opponent mm-hmm. an advantage, and you're not going to agree to debate on those grounds, right? So each one of the debates is a miracle.
Right.
We begin by going out with what we think is the right kind of motion language. We gather a ton of expertise and research and insight from the leading voices and thinkers and writers and researchers on these topics. And then we're going to approach guests with a very carefully crafted question on the topic that we think, after all that work, is really balanced. So the best debates that we've done have perfected that language, that it's balanced for both sides, that it's intriguing for an audience, that it has the depth and complexity to challenge two of the most extraordinary thinkers or four of the most extraordinary thinkers and policymakers in the world on a topic. And so I would say there's different metrics for success. When I think about a debate that I was shocked at how big it became and continues to reverberate, it's actually on genetically modified food.
Hmm.
Which is increasingly politicized. And both sides have a lot yeah. of sort of competing research, but interests
right.
In their two sides. So
what was the
The proposition was just genetically modify food. Yes or no.
Uh-huh.
It was very simple. Also, that's a
yeah.
metric to success is distilling really complex
right.
ideas into 3 to 5 word propositions.
Yeah. What was the pro take generally, and what was the anti take?
Pro take is, you know, genetically modifying food isn't anything new.
Right.
We've been at this now for thousands of years. The kernel of corn that you eat today and mm-hmm. the banana that you're used to seeing are the results of so many different experiments, so many different mm-hmm. modifications to be able to weather storms, soil hardiness, mm-hmm. all of these things. Scale food production and agriculture to be able to solve world poverty
right.
someday.
Yeah.
So that's one side. The other side is that we don't know what the effects of these, of genetically modifying is. There's
mm-hmm.
a lot of other chemicals. There's pesticides. There's erosion of soil
mm-hmm.
from all kinds of modified. It gets a little complicated on their side.
Yeah.
You have to modify a seed.
Right.
In order for it to grow properly. And then the soil has to be modified as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's chemical compounds in that.
And I guess
and
they're arguing it's one thing when farmers are cross hybridizing seeds, et cetera, and doing experiments that take longer than when you can inject new, you know, fish genes into a tomato
totally.
Or something like
that. Totally. And what is the long-term effect of that?
Right.
You know, this is one grandiose experiment.
Yeah. And that is also, I mean, so you have like two strong arguments that are kind of, you know, mutually exclusive, but clear. And then why do you think, like, why did that resonate with an audience?
I think it resonates because this is, this affects your daily life. Mm-hmm. You go to Whole Foods and how many products say right there, non-GMO?
Right.
Well, why is that inherently, like, do people question that? Oh, mm-hmm. they're just, if somebody's putting non-GMO on a label, that means it's bad, right? GMOs are bad.
Yeah.
So that's the starting point where most people are coming at this. That debate, you had a lot of celebrities. You had Alicia Silverstone mm-hmm. tweeting to her, as a vegan, tweeting to her whole audience to say, we shouldn't be genetically modifying food. Mm-hmm. You know, come to this debate, you know, vote this way.
Yeah.
There's something at stake yeah. when it's something you really believe in mm-hmm. and that affects your daily life or that you're trying to understand more of. But most people in the New York audience, we recorded this live mm-hmm. in New York, came to this that were anti-GMO. They're just bad. I don't know why, but they're bad.
Right.
It's on every yeah. label.
If
at
somebody
the grocery
is
store.
Advertising that this doesn't have this in it, it's probably bad.
It's probably bad.
Right. Which, of course, I have to say personally, I find a ridiculous position. But who ended up winning that debate?
The pro GMO side won that debate.
All right.
Well, and yeah. It's
But
the biggest, and there were two documentaries there, mm-hmm. and it's been featured in multiple places, yeah. and it's just had a long idea shelf life.
Right.
But the most interesting—
Not unlike GMO foods, right? That oftentimes are guaranteed,
yes.
you know, are made to last longer through the miracle of science. But
there you go. I know which side you're on.
Yeah. But that's also part of it is, I mean, what goes into a good debate is that people are not hiding their positions,
right?
That they're being open, like, here are my priors, and then this is the specific case, right?
Well, this is where debate's unique. So that debate, the success story really is, Bill Nye, mm-hmm. the science guy, was in the audience, stood up and yeah. asked a question, and he directed it toward Rob Fraley, who's the, at the time, was the chief technology officer of Monsanto.
Right.
And said to Rob, you know, it's bad science. I'm paraphrasing this. You can watch yeah. it in the debate, but it's basically, how can you as a scientist stand behind the research on GMOs? It's less than 15 years old. There's no way you can guarantee safety. You know, this is unethical, bad science.
Yeah.
And Rob Fraley said, it's not. We've done everything. You know, we mm-hmm. know that this is safe. We know we can solve big problems in this world and feed people in places that are harsh climates and where there's like very little sustenance. Come to my lab. I'll show you our research. I want to show you what we're doing. And so he agreed. Bill Nye went to the Monsanto lab, spent time with Rob. Saw everything, saw research, samples, all this stuff. But basically, a week later, went on the record saying, I've changed my mind as a result of this. I am now confident in the science of GMOs. And, you know, I'm going to stand by that as scientifically sound.
Yeah. So,
that's a huge, yeah. to me, that is as a big of a metric of right. success that you can have, where you're really changing the way even your leading thinkers think about their own work.
What are some topics, what are other topics that have done particularly well? And do you say, is it, you know, you want the proposition to be, you know, tight and fair and like generative of a discussion, but are there particular topics that people are really, seem really hungry for?
Yeah.
So, you know, like a real open and honest and fair discussion of?
Religion.
Yeah.
The video on our YouTube channel that continues to amass views every month, mm-hmm. and we're not promoting it, and we're not, we're not doing anything here. It was presented in 2010. The motion was Islam is a religion of peace. And that continues to spark a huge debate online. And the thing that's great about that particular debate, which had Ayaan Hirsi Ali, had Douglas Murray, Ziba Khan, and Majid Nawaz, mm-hmm. is they made such sound arguments, but accessible. They were coming at it from personal experience. It's not just data sets. There's data, but there's personal experience too. And that kind of testimony, in addition to evidence, I think gets people really engaged. So it's beyond just an expert.
Right.
You know
how did that go? which side won?
Let me see. In this debate, I had to pull this up because it's now 13 years old from our prior, work as Intelligence Squared U.S. But it's basically that Islam is not a religion of peace. Okay. Won that debate. And in fact, I believe that here 13 years later, one of those debaters has since changed their mind on that topic.
What are topics that are not, that are considered undiscussable even in an open debate format like you're hosting?
Do you mean in terms of like a hot button? Contentious we couldn't.
Yeah, what are topics that are, that are not worthy of debate?
Look, not worthy of debate is something like flat earth. Mm-hmm. That is just not an intellectually respectable point of view. We have data and science and we know the earth is not flat.
Right.
So that's a level that we're just not going to indulge, or conspiracy theories. Yeah. And
what about something like, I'm thinking of the lab leak theory about the COVID-19, which went from being, an absolute sign that you wore, not just a tinfoil hat, but an entire tinfoil suit, you're crazy, you're a conspiracy freak, to kind of now being accepted as probably the reason that things, that COVID-19 happened. Mm-hmm. How do you negotiate that kind of, weird shift where you go from insane to mainstream?
That happens with a lot of topics, mm-hmm. because the amount of information we have when a news story breaks or mm-hmm. something's happening obviously changes over mm-hmm. months and months. And as journalists investigate, as we learn more from our public policy officials, as there's more information coming to the forefront. So oftentimes we will start producing a topic mm-hmm. and then realize it's just not ready to debate yet. It's a tool to understand two sides, mm-hmm. but if you don't have a full grasp of information mm-hmm. or balanced information on two sides, it's not a fair contest.
Right.
So you will be talking past each other, or one side's using all anecdotes and the other side's using data. Mm-hmm. And that's totally unsatisfying because it's not a head-to-head, debate. Right. So in that case, that's something that we would default to our experts. We mm-hmm. go to them and say, hey, do we have serious data on both sides? Do we have enough mm-hmm. evidence? Is there enough scholarly support? Mm. And this, again, it spans a lot of different topics, especially medicine and science.
Have you had any debates that have gone catastrophically wrong? Or how would you define like real duds?
Mm.
And I don't know if that would mean maybe, people on the same side start disagreeing with each other, or I guess partly it's a question of like, it doesn't connect with an audience is one thing, but that's kind of, you never know why, something goes big or not, but, just where the discourse itself is just not very illuminating.
Well, not to undermine the excellence of our quality work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But like I said, every debate's a miracle. Not every debate is perfect.
Right.
Some of them, you're in the process of trying to uncover changes in society, mm-hmm. and it's a moving target. Mm-hmm. I would say, we've had a couple of debates where a debater got on stage and then refused to argue the resolution. Mm-hmm. That is very difficult to navigate. They're with a team member. Then the onus falls on their team member to make the argument almost solo. And so those debaters have been extraordinary. To stand up to having a team member that kind of throws them under the bus.
Yeah.
And that does happen in our debates sometimes. Rarely, very rarely, but it has happened. Other times a debater might actually change their mind or try and rephrase the language.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of realize, say, 15 minutes in that they're arguing a proposition that isn't resonating with this audience, or they see an uphill battle.
Mm-hmm.
So they try and reframe it.
Yeah.
And John Donvan, who's our moderator, and Nick, you've moderated.
Mm-hmm.
It's your job to make sure that when they pull those shenanigans, which we know is always a possibility, right. actually, mm-hmm. you're going to want to reframe something to be in your favor if you're in a debate. But that if it's pretty extreme, to bring it back and remind everybody that this is the question we're debating, not this version of the question that's been presented.
I mean, I think, at you know, again, as both as a participant, but especially as a viewer and consumer of your stuff, what I love is when, you know, people are forced to answer the question or the point that they're clearly trying to work around because they don't want to talk about it, but it's obviously relevant and whatnot. And I think you guys do a really good job of that.
Well, that's actually the power of a debate versus a conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a panel discussion, everyone can kind of give a wishy-washy answer, non-committal, or perhaps give a great definitive answer, but not have to have a point of view challenged. Right. There's no challenging in real time going on. And that's what distinguishes this, is the moderator is going to hold you accountable for defending your side.
Before we continue with the recent interview, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp Online Therapy. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. If you're having any sort of troubles in your life, you might benefit from therapy. And I want to tell you that BetterHelp is a great service, whether you're feeling anxious, depressed, or just like you're not the best version of yourself. BetterHelp is entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and you get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. I know that BetterHelp is a great service because I used it myself for about 2 years and it really made a difference for me. Visit betterhelp.com/TRI to get 10% off your first month. The TRI stands for the recent interview. Make sure to get a discount on your first month if you're a listener of this podcast. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TRI. You can also check the show notes at reason.com to get a good link there. And now, back to the recent interview with Clay O'Connor. You know, why don't we talk a little bit about why, you know, we've talked about why debate is important, you know, and it's a process by which, you know, hopefully a free society or any society like gains more information and knowledge. Excuse me. It helps, you know, it helps us figure out what's true and what isn't, or what we're accepting as true for the foreseeable future. Always subject to revision, but the flip side of that is, why does debate seem to, or rich discussion seem to have gone missing? And, you know, Americans, like, we have a cult of debate. You know, we think about the Lincoln Douglas debates, and there's even a high school program of debate that's based on that. And, you know, you always look back and hear, you know, whether it's, you know, Hamilton or 1776, there's plays about where the founders argue everything in real time and come to decisions. Do you agree that good, honest debate in a public forum just seems to have gone missing? And if so, what are the causes for that?
It definitely was missing before we were established in the early 2000s. There wasn't a live forum for debate in the United States. There were a couple of debate shows. I mean, and there has been, like, think about Firing Line, you know, with Buckley back. You know, that was definitely a debate, or the Buckley Vidal debates. Again, this is all kind of happening in the era of television,
right? And those are high water. I mean, people still refer back to that, or I mean, thinking about it, it's interesting. Bill Buckley comes up a lot in this, but because of Firing Line, Vidal and his, you know, celebrated debate with James Baldwin at Oxford in England, you know, where he got his clock clean.
But, and if you haven't seen the documentary Best of Enemies, is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have that kind of in our DNA. And I know a lot of people who think back, including myself, like I find myself watching old Firing Lines. I kind of remember them, you know, being on Channel 13 when I, you know, couldn't wrest control of the TV from my parents and they would be watching something boring. But you go on YouTube and it's fascinating because he had a range of people who disagreed about stuff, but then, you know, they really went at it. I even think back to daytime shows like the Mike Douglas Show and Dinah Shore. I post this probably once a year. There's an episode where Milton Friedman, Shayna Alexander, the journalist, and Phyllis Diller are talking about tax policy and interest rates on Dinah Shore's couch. And it's kind of like, we don't see that in the same way anymore. It seems like it's all, it's more like The View or something, where it's like basically everybody agrees and, you know, and they're just ragging on the one person who might not agree.
Right.
But
right.
So why has debate gone missing?
I think debate has gone missing because we ended up with really partisan mainstream media perspectives. And you don't have to engage in debate. There was a really interesting study, I think it's Berkeley, that did brain scans of people listening to information that they disagreed with, that really challenged their religion, their political leanings, their, you know, value system, and found that the areas of the brain that were activated were the same as fight and flight. There's a physical, biological response to being challenged that we actually have to learn how to deal with. And that learning is the process of critical thinking. And that's not taught. We don't teach debate. We don't teach that process of questioning what you hear, of questioning your peers. That's part of education any longer.
Yeah, because when I think back, my parents who were born in the 20s, you know, had like forensics clubs, you know, that's what debate was called back then, et cetera. And you still have that.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I seem to remember, I was certainly getting yelled at a lot in school, but it seemed like people argued a lot, at least. But, you know, when did it stop being taught? And, you know, at the K through 12 level, and then, you know, in college, it seems this, you know, is a rich, I mean, it's a topic of discussion itself, right? Like, is the academy, you know, completely a monoculture, an ideological monoculture or not?
Well, there's a lot of organizations working on that, like, as you know, and I'm sure the Reason audience knows, FIRE and Heterodox Academy and Jonathan Haidt and Brilliant Minds saying, taking a look at academia and saying, if we continue down this path, we're going to end up with that monoculture, with one way of thinking, or, you know, really with a society that can't engage with people that you disagree with.
Right.
And that's kind of how it's culminated in cancel culture in a lot of ways, where you're going to get called out or threatened or canceled for saying things that are deemed inappropriate.
Have you
Some
guys,
of them are inappropriate, to be clear, but...
Well, and what is allowable and not
kind
of changes, so it's hard to say... You know, it was a great time in, you know, American culture when people could use the N-word freely, right? Or something like that, because it doesn't quite work that way. But have you guys debated cancel culture?
Yeah, we have.
What were the propositions and how did those go?
So that one was, let me pull it up really quick. You can edit this part out.
Sure.
I want to get it right. That had Camille Foster, which was cancel culture is toxic.
Yeah.
So the framing for the debate was the question, is cancel culture toxic?
Right.
Camille Foster and Garry Kasparov, they debated that it is from two very different perspectives. You had Eric Hatala-Mathis. He's a professor of philosophy. And you had Karen Atiyah from The Washington Post. So, you know, this debate, the reason it was so good is it hit the nail on the head in saying, defining what is cancel culture, because I don't think there's a broad consensus on exactly what cancel culture
is. Yeah, because some people say it's cancel culture. Other people say it's accountability.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
And those two sides said that, but they had to arrive at a shared definition of cancel culture. And then I think Garry brought in some arguments that expanded your thinking about what cancel culture is when you're coming from, you know, when he's talking about being a dissident.
Yeah.
You know, and he's saying, hey, we can't have a cancel culture in a thriving democracy. You have to have a freedom of speech. That's kind of the core of a functioning democracy, the ability to challenge what the government is saying.
Yeah.
For the press to stand up to the government and so on and so forth. And he's coming at it from the experience of being exiled.
Right.
The ultimate cancel.
He's fascinating.
Really brought it to another level.
He was the culmination of Soviet culture in a way.
Right.
I mean, he became, you know, one of the most famous people on the planet and certainly in the Soviet Union by becoming chess champion. And to turn against that system that had produced him is kind of an amazing act, apart from whatever else you want to say about Garry Kasparov.
Totally. Totally.
So part of this is clearly in school, we're not taught to kind of think about belief systems apart from our kind of, I don't know if I want to say like our emotional response to them, or, you know, there's a kind of, whatever, and I don't want to mythologize it, but maybe in the past people were more willing to say, okay, like defend that position. I don't agree with you, or for the sake of argument, make a case on the other side of what you believe or something.
Right.
That seems to have receded in education, K-12, college, mm-hmm. grad school even. What are the other elements that have kind of destroyed a robust, positive debate culture?
I think social media mm-hmm. is probably culprit number one. Mm-hmm. We've debated social media many times okay. and whether or not it's a force for good mm-hmm. for democracies. At this point, I think with generational divides, you know, that's something you and I have talked a lot mm-hmm. about, the internet, social media.
So when you say social media, like how does the debates that you've had, so it's social media is good for democracy mm-hmm. and the debates are like, no, it's not, or yes, it is.
Yeah. One side is very clearly saying social media has had a net negative on democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, you can create these cultures of extremes that mm-hmm. don't have to engage with the other side
right.
that can fester. That can cause bigger problems or create, you know, misinformation, disinformation, mm. malinformation, call it what you will, campaigns.
Information.
Counterinformation.
It's so amazing but these are also I guess things are always changing, but I remember, you know, there was when Twitter emerged in the late aughts, what a sense of power that this was allowing dissidents in places like Iran and yeah. Ukraine, you know, clicks ago in the mm-hmm. Arab Spring, this, it empowered that.
Completely.
And now it seems like we're sour. I mean, is it social media, or is it the people using social media, or well, are we formed, you know, does social media use us, or do we use it?
Well, maybe the Arab Spring is a really interesting yeah. example, because now there's like a regression mm-hmm. in those places where there was this movement toward, you know, independence and
right.
freedom. So it's gone the other way.
Yeah.
So perhaps there's a period where social media could empower and liberate voices. And then now there's an area or new time
yeah.
where it can't do that. Or it's been shut down,
right.
you know, by governments. So that's where those two sides largely shook out in that debate. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's a debate you could practically produce every year.
Sure. Yeah.
because
yeah.
the algorithms change.
Yeah.
And that we don't have any transparency or visibility into.
Right, right. Talk a little bit about generational issues. Mm. Is that, you know, do you think that is a meaningful way to approach attitudes towards debate, you know, and really open and honest, good faith debates? Because, it, you know, this is boomers, you know, who raised millennials and Gen Z. Are, you know, constantly talking about snowflakes. You know, they, of course, were considered snowflakes by their parents, et cetera. But,
right.
you know, is there, and in my experience, and I say this as somebody who was born at the very end of the baby boom, like it does seem like the world I grew up in, it was a lot more kind of in your face of saying, like, defend that position, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, come on.
Yeah, there wasn't this response that was, I don't have to, I'm right.
Yeah, or that even asking somebody to define their terms is an impossible affront. That means I will never engage you.
Right. It's disrespectful. I don't need to, and I wouldn't give a platform to
right.
somebody I disagree with.
Right.
And you're seeing that right now in politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, that happened in the last gubernatorial race in Arizona.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, how much is, you know, is there a generational split, or is it more attitudinal, or, you know, and how do you hope to address that and or create the next kind of generation of like people who don't just suffer debate, but actually actively engage in it mm-hmm. and kind of use it as a way of moving forward as a society?
There's definitely with with, I think, every generation, finger pointing about what they messed up and what we're going to fix and what needs to be done and, you know, all of that. But one of the things about being open to debate is trying to understand another person's point of view. And that goes for older generations and younger generations. And that's why having the framing of a question versus just coming at it with, you know, okay, your example of white supremacy. America is a, you know, a nation of white supremacists. Mm-hmm. That's not a productive framing, mm-hmm. right, for a conversation. So you might, if you're challenged that way, say you have a teenager, which I do, who's 17 mm-hmm. years old, and you have a lot of these claims and defiant statements mm-hmm. being made about right and wrong and about identity in particular, you know, starting from a place where the question that we agree to answer, mm-hmm. we're on the same page. Right. You're starting with like one question instead of a big, broad, you know, open-ended conversation that's going to end up going nowhere.
Yeah.
You know? So I think it's actually a helpful tool to have in engaging across a generational mm-hmm. divide. I think it should happen more. You know, you and I had a chat at one point of having some kind of debate program with, right. you know, hosted by, say, Gen Z and a boomer.
Yeah.
Really talking about where there's a total lack of agreement. But why? That's the interesting thing.
Yeah.
You know, so, but if your ideas go unchallenged and you don't have to actually engage with people you disagree with, then you're not going to grow, you know, and you're not going to expand your thinking.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. That's one of the reasons we're going with open to debate.
Right.
As a new direction. I mean, actually to engage younger audiences and remind you should be open to debate and open-minded.
Are you optimistic about the future? Because, you know, every year it seems, you know, the number of people who believe America is on the wrong track continues to, you know, get bigger. And it's, you know, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, well, you know, whether it's the pandemic or, you know, recession or inflation, you know, are you optimistic that people will be more interested in kind of arguing about stuff in good faith and for the purpose of discovering something approaching truth, as opposed to
right.
just kind of scoring, you know, ideological points or feeling good about themselves?
Yeah. I am optimistic because that's what we're here for. Mm. You know, we're actually trying to create that contempt-free zone mm-hmm. where you feel, I mean, I hate to use the word safe space, but it's actually a great application
right.
of that phrase that's been so co-opted by academia. Mm. But a safe space to actually have a debate and disagree. I'm confident that we're going to get there because I think there's going to be a correction in the tolerance people have for the shutdown of free speech and ideas mm-hmm. on social media or by activists or by the extremes on both sides. Mm-hmm. And I think that people are becoming so much more aware of bias in their sort of daily diet of media consumption. I mean, if you just scroll through Twitter at any given moment, you have people questioning in a much bigger way than a few years ago, where did this information come from? Why should I listen to you? mm-hmm. You know, and I think that that's actually going to help us get to a point where we can have open and honest and fair debates again. We've been having them for sure. But one of the reasons we want to go to open to debate is to have more of them and invite more people to the table and have more perspectives and points of view compared and contrasted. You know, I am really optimistic that will happen. I think we've reached that inflection point. I think different scholars may have different points of it, but certainly the insurrection on the Capitol was mm-hmm. a moment where I think we as a culture and a country had to say, wait a minute. You know, how did this happen? And of course, it's playing out in court and all of that. Mm-hmm. We just did a debate on whether or not January 6th was an existential crisis to democracy or not. Mm-hmm. But the bigger thing is there's no that, how would I say this? One side or both sides feel they're not heard by the other. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're acting out. And you're seeing now all of this concern about future political violence and what that means to national security, elections, fair and or rigged elections. We now actually need debate, because if you're not going to engage with these two sides, you end up with that level of problem.
Yeah.
You know, so this is, in my opinion, the work that we're doing and being nonpartisan about it and always having multiple points of view and having debaters argue in good faith. Yeah. That's definitely core tenet of the program. That's a key to you know, saving democracy. Do you think that democracy is in decline?
Can I ask, are you guys trying to do, to talk about, you started out talking about the 1960 presidential debate.
Yeah.
You know, the presidential debates, there wasn't another presidential debate until 1976. And, you know, and it's looking likely that there may not be presidential debates, you know, in 2024.
Well, what gives you that sense?
Well, the Republican Party has said they're not going to participate. And I think,
Party has said that they're not participating in debates curated by the Commission on Presidential Debates.
Yeah.
So the CPD has been the governing body. It's this bipartisan effort, you know,
to keep, presidential debates as useless as possible for its entire, and also to keep out, you know, other voices that have the potential, you know, that are on the ballot in all 50 states. I was going to ask, though, are you guys pursuing a presidential debate hosting capability?
We are actively pursuing being the next format to come in and host the presidential debates in 2024. I'm very optimistic and hopeful that they will take place. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of that needs to happen before we get there.
I mean, I guess this is, you know, it's one thing for kind of thought leaders and intellectuals and academics and activists. You know, it's hard enough for them to be like, okay, I'm going to put my reputation and my galaxy brain on trial by being in a public debate. But why would any politician agree to a debate where they would actually be asked difficult questions?
I mean, they didn't for 16 years.
Yeah. No, I know. That's what I'm saying.
I mean, there were no debates before that either.
Yeah.
That was because of FCC laws on equal airtime.
Yeah.
Equal political airtime.
But are you hopeful?
That was actually suspended for 1 year in 1960 so those debates could take place.
Yeah.
And then for the next 16 years, the candidates saw what happened in those Nixon-Kennedy debates and said, why would I do that? You know, if you're an incumbent, you don't want to risk the possibility of having a challenger outshine you on a debate stage.
And in fact, Ford in 1976 only agreed to it because he was behind in the polls to Jimmy Carter.
He said, so, what else am I going to do?
Yeah.
But, I actually need to debate.
So what I'm asking, though, is if you guys are actually hosting the debates, they're not going to be these kind of bloviation platforms where each candidate just gets to, you know, do a 3-minute riff on whatever they want to talk about.
Right.
So
that's not a debate.
Yeah, I know. How do you get, you know, Joe Biden or whoever the Democratic candidate is and the Republican candidate to actually, you know, submit to an actual fair discussion and analysis of their ideas?
Well, first, you make it a debate format. Mm-hmm. What we see now are joint press conferences with, you know, really rehearsed talking points. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's almost nothing that distinguishes the current presidential debates from what you hear on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. So for us, the priority is certainly putting forward debate formats and moderators that are actually helping us understand where these two candidates are coming from and what they believe, and enabling them to, what's the word that actually of this book here, right? I don't know if you've read this. I know we won't go there, but
it's a book about the presidential debates.
Yeah. So the book is Inside the Presidential Debates, but, you know, to actually engage with each other on stage directly, right? So it's not just question from a journalist to candidate A, question from a journalist to candidate B, question from a journalist to candidate A, candidate B, and rinse and repeat for an hour and a half.
Right.
They're ad hominem attacks. They're really repetitive. Mm-hmm. There's question dodging. In that format, if you're just, it's just a question and answer format, it is easy to evade a question because you're not, you don't have to have your point held accountable by your opponent. So the first things first is to actually have a debate format. Now, we know it's highly political. And to your point of, you know, if you're the incumbent, do you really want to debate, you know, at all?
Yeah.
But I think there's a, to the CPD's credit, I think there's a track record now. The American public expects debates from our highest office of elected officials. And I'm pretty confident we would be able to make those happen. I would love to see, I think following, maybe we'll still follow this. We're still working on our stuff here, but we might follow the structure of having a general, you know, sort of several topics that we go through in a debate. But rather than every single, you know, you go from China to healthcare to identity politics to democracy to, you know, local issues to immigration. And, you know, you can spend, what, 2 minutes on each one of those hugely complex issues. I mean, how do you really know what these candidates are going to be doing? We don't get serious policy out of the current presidential debates. So first is limiting it to the most important buckets of information and curating those, which we know how to do, which we've just talked about, 15-year history of consolidating really complex things into questions that have a lot of space for exploration. So I think we can do presidential debates like an unresolved format, you know, a series of five questions that you're yes or no to with opening remarks, with a structured, you know, engagement period there, an Oxford-style debate. I mean, I'd love to see an Oxford-style debate with the presidential candidate and their vice presidential candidate debating together. I understand if that's delusional, but I would love to see that.
That would be incredible.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you're voting for both of them.
Right.
You know, so I'd like to see the dynamic of how our president and vice president actually work together. And then, you know, having a domestic policy focused debate as well as a foreign policy debate, but really structuring this so that you have not better questions, but framing, framing to guide the conversation, a moderator that isn't going to tolerate, you know, sort of rehearsed, just repetitive talking points and attacks on their opponent.
Yeah. All right.
I know it's a pie in the sky at the moment.
But I think if it happens, I'll know I'm having a stroke, but, but it sounds fantastic.
Well, me too.
Yeah.
No, I think there's a real, appetite now to get away from that era. The CPD laid out the possibility to have a debate every election, you know, and we all hate them. And they are broadly considered to be just, you know, laughable at the end of the day. But make no mistake, it is pretty hard to get your presidential candidates to take the stage. And certainly don't underestimate the power of our political committees to try and influence every aspect of debates. So I think our approach is really going to be having a proposal that is all about elevating these conversations in the interest of our candidates and our voters. So I think we can do it.
Well, I hope you do. I want to thank Clay O'Connor, the head of Open to Debate, for talking to Reason. Thank you, Clay.
Thanks, Nick. Thank you, Reason.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, please go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Rate and review us and subscribe. We put out 2 Reason Interview podcasts a week now. You don't want to miss anything. We'll come directly to wherever you want to send them. Or make it really easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcast. That's reason.com/podcast and subscribe there. And while you're there, check out the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum Debates, our other 2 regular podcast series. If you like the Reason Interview, you're going to love the Reason Roundtable and the SOA Forum Debates. And one more thing, go to reason.com/events to check out what we're up to, especially in New York City. On Monday, June 5th, for instance, I'm going to be hosting a live version of this very podcast with the Gutfeld and Fox News contributor Kat Timpf, whose best-selling new book is You Can't Joke About That. Tickets are $10 and include beer, wine, soft drinks, and food. So go to reason.com/events for details on all that. Thanks for listening.